Good morning, everybody. It is it's a real pleasure to be with you here this morning. My name is Sid, and I think my claim to fame in Kelowna is that I am the husband of Jennifer Koop, who is the executive director of Green Bay Bible Camp. Actually, there's a clap. I heard that. That might have been Caden, but Caden knows that he needs to clap or he's in trouble this summer. I apologize to you. We are stealing Caden back from you over the next couple of months as he and Emma are going to come and invest in probably the program at Green Bay that is most dear to my heart, which is the leadership development of our grade 9 and 10s. And so they're the directors of that program. Luke and Sophia have gone through the program here. Keith Kids, Luke's in it. And so I know that it's been really great for Caden to be here over this past year. Thank you for loving him really well and helping shape him. And I got to sit in the audience and listen to Caden preach for the first time when he first preached. And thank you again for allowing him to have that space here as well. That's not small key. Thank you for investing in him. Really appreciate that. I'm really privileged to be here this morning because this is Chris's last Sunday here. And I have known Chris for a very long time now, Chris. It's probably been over 2 decades, I think. Over 2 decades, yeah. So I had the opportunity, and I still do, to teach in a leadership program at Camp Kiwanis called Kaleo. And one of the first times I was there, Chris was in that program. And I'd gotten to know him a little bit when I would speak at that camp in the summer, and you were on staff, and then you worked with Kiwanis. And so we overlapped in that space. And then when Chris made the decision to come to Kelowna, I got to be a little bit of a part of that when he started on staff at Trinity. And then he went through, we run a 2-year program for youth ministry leadership development called The Coalition. And Chris was in our program, and so I had the opportunity to be with him there, and then now here in the space. And I guess I would say to you and Alicia, thank you so much for your faithfulness, Chris. Do you know what I mean? That'd be appropriate. Really, really beautiful. You know, it's an interesting thing, and I mean, we're going to talk about this morning on how do we pass a courageous faith on to the next generation, or next generation. How do you own a deep, courageous, rooted faith? And I don't take it for granted anymore. I'm at this age, by the way, I'm a little bit older now, so I have a few years that I can look back on. I don't take it for granted when I meet young leaders and I wonder what their future will be. And the dream is that 20 years later, Chris, what you and Alicia are doing would be the future, would have been the vision. And not only have you remained faithful to Jesus and his call on your life to sacrifice much for his work in leading others, you've also done that with your own kids. And you continue to fight to be faithful parents in that space, which there's no greater honor. Thank you for owning that so well and continuing to fight to faithfully love them and help them see the beauty of Jesus in your life as well. And I just want to say thank you. And it's such a privilege to know you and also, you know, from a distance, and to see how you've been just wonderfully faithful and not to your ministry but to each other. How beautiful is that? We don't take that for granted. And so bless you as you move on to what's next, you know. Bless you. I just turned 53 just a couple of weeks ago. And in my family, we die pretty young. I'm going to be honest with you. Now, don't get too concerned. It just means I get to heaven first. You know what I'm saying? So I'm actually winning that game. And Jen, my wife, was quite aware of it when we got married. So I was like, babe, you know, it's going to be a good time, just maybe not a long time. Anyways, and then it'll be a really long time after that, which is going to be awesome. But, you know, you get into some of these spaces. My father passed away at 48, my brother at 55, my uncle 48, et cetera, et cetera. But you get in this space and you just go, you start to reflect a little bit and you just go, Lord, thank you. Like, thank you for allowing us to be invested in this work of helping the next generation know Jesus. And I don't think there's a greater call for any generation. I don't think there's a greater call for any generation. And grandparents, especially you in this room, will understand this, right? Than like passing the faith of Jesus Christ on to the next generation. And there's not too many more joys, are there? Do you know what I mean? Like, I talk to my mom and dad, my wife's mom and dad, and the joy they have in their grandchildren loving Jesus is amazing. And I watch how they invest in our kids. I watch how they model forward what it is to continue to love Jesus, even in challenging times. And I think what an incredible legacy they've given to our children. And I'm so thankful for that. I'm just so thankful for that. And so to be in this space to just speak a little bit more about that, it's a real privilege. At Green Bay, we say this is kind of Christmas Eve. This is the moment before the best day ever, which is when camp starts for us, and we become a little bit reflective on things. And I was thinking about the staff that are going to be showing up at camp here over the next little while. And again, I said to Keith that at this stage of my life, to be able to be with students who are fighting to serve and love Jesus, again, what a privilege. I was thinking about Cruz. Cruz was one of our staff from last summer, and we're going to get Cruz back, and I'm really thankful for that. Cruz is a grade 11 student and just really committed. I mean, he's all in, and I discovered that last summer really well, even when it's not easy. Like, he is in, and that's what you're looking for. You're looking for those, the ones who've kind of been battle-tested. They've been through the struggles, and still there's like a joy and a love for Jesus even in the midst of some of the tensions. You know what I mean? So last summer, I think Cruz probably had the toughest cabin that I've seen at camp over the last couple of years, to be honest with you. And we didn't realize it at first. Do you know what I mean? We weren't aware. We made a mistake, by the way. We checked the records afterwards, after the week. He was really thankful we checked it after the week was over. We discovered that accidentally, every single kid that we placed in his cabin was on behavioral meds. And so that was going to be a unique challenge for Cruz. We could have warned him if we would have known it, but we'd missed it. We realized things weren't quite right by about halfway through the week with a number of incident reports that we were receiving from that one cabin. And at that point, we started meeting with Cruz. I remember grade 11, he said, "Cruz, how you doing?" He goes, "I'm making it, Sid. I'm making it." I said, "Bless you, brother. Woo! Praying for you right now." And so we started to invest in him. It was interesting at the end of the summer when we were around as staff doing our time of just kind of reflecting on the summer, and everyone was standing up and we were sharing about ways that you had seen God at work over the summer. And then all of a sudden, kind of Cruz stands up. We've got like 150 staff there, whatever it is. And he stands up and goes, "Hey, I'm Cruz." Everyone goes, "Hi, Cruz." You know, it's like they're feeling his pain. We're just celebrating the fact that he's still alive, actually. So that's awesome. And then he stands up and he goes, you know, "My summer was a little bit challenging, especially first couple of weeks." And everyone's like, "Yeah," kind of that awkward chuckle. And then he just goes, "You know what, though? Like, God, he saw me through, and it wasn't easy." He said, he goes, "You know, every single day," he said, "I would wake up every day. I would get up a little bit before the kids would get up." He said, "I would go out of my cabin, and I would just kind of walk a bit, and I would pray. And then I would focus on Jesus. I go, 'Jesus, you know, you're so good.'" And he goes, "Jesus, today is going to be a better day." He goes, "I'm in. Today is going to be a better day." And then he looks at the crowd, at the staff. He goes, "And you know what?" And they're like, "What?" He goes, "It wasn't." He goes, "Yeah, it wasn't one single day that was a better day." You know, when we think about kind of the context that we're in beyond camp, there's seasons when we feel like maybe this is our reality. And I wonder if for you in the next generation, in the moments when you really reflect on what's taking place in our world right now, do you know what I mean? You take a look at some of the chaos and the crisis that we're experiencing broadly. I mean, we have much here. We're covered in so many ways. But even here, within our own environment, when we begin to feel parents, grandparents, like the values of culture that seem to be more and more affirmed, our intention with the culture or the values that we follow as followers of Christ, or we long to define our reality, and we kind of feel the sense of being more and more marginalized, perhaps, in the public square. We find the challenges that we're facing to grow. We find the uncertainty of the future continue to grow, and we wonder, "Lord, how do we remain strong in the midst of this? How do we remain firm in the midst of this?" Especially for those of us who are going through situations when we wake up every day and we go, "God, could today be a better day?" And at the end of the day, we go, "Ah, it wasn't better. In fact, in some ways, it was harder." And those of us who are older know, younger generation, high school students, middle school, that there will be seasons like that for you. It's going to be true. But is there a way that in the midst of those times that there could be such a rooted faith that even in those seasons, even in the midst of the tears, even in the midst of the difficulty, still we could go, "But my God is good. And I'm okay because my God is good." What would it look like for us to have that type of a faith, that type of a resilient, stable, rooted faith that would see us through the dark seasons and the hard seasons with a type of hope that would be transformative in the spaces where we are? What could that actually look like? So this is what Peter is speaking about in the book of 1 Peter. If you have your Bibles, you can open up to 1 Peter chapter 2. We're going to take a quick look primarily at verses 9 and 10, and we'll bounce into 11 a little bit as well. But just really quickly, Peter is writing to a group of people who have become marginalized by the general culture around them. So probably when Peter was written, the church, while fairly young, has not been like systematically targeted by the government. That's coming when Nero continues to grow in power and he begins to like systematically oppress the Christian community. At this point in time, they are feeling certainly a type of oppression, but it's not systematic yet. It's just kind of communal. People don't respect who they are. They don't understand who they are. They're living by very different sets of values. They're losing positions of power. Their voice doesn't matter much within kind of the public sphere. And in this moment, the church is kind of shrinking and people are shrinking and they're wondering, who should we be in this space? How should we function in this space? What's necessary for us to continue to be a people rooted in relationship with Jesus? And Peter comes and he speaks to them. And he comes to them and he begins to remind them who they are, who they belong to, what their mission is, how they're to be in this environment that God has sovereignly placed them. And listen to what he says in 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10. He says, but remember this, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Okay. How do we like embrace a courageous faith? Young leaders, you know, high school, college, how do we embrace a courageous faith in an environment or space where sometimes it feels like the general culture is against us? And next generation, older folks here, how do we continue to pass on that type of faith to the next generation? I think Peter gives us at least three ideas. Here's the first thing. Number one, we need to help the next generation know who they are. There's an issue of identity that Peter is speaking here. That in a culture where the values are so different than the types of values that Jesus in his kingdom way would call us to embrace, we have to remember who we are. We have to know who we are. This has to be at the very core of our being. Listen to what Peter says. He says, but you are a chosen race. You are a royal priesthood. You are a holy nation, a people for his own possession. Did you hear that? There's three identities that he gives us here. The first one is this. He says, remember, you are a chosen race. Notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say that you're a choice race. Did you hear that? He doesn't say, oh man, you guys are so amazing and awesome. I just had to choose you. Like, it was really clear. If I'm going to win, I need you. You're the greatest. That's actually not how God works. Isn't that true? And isn't that incredibly good news, actually? Isn't it good news? I mean, my son, he's been at Briarcrest for the last year. He's coming back here. He did 2 years at UBCO, and now he'll be back for his third year at UBCO. And he plays basketball. And so this is the season, I just talked with him this morning, when he's beginning to feel the pressure of being part of the quote-unquote choice people for the team. Maybe get a scholarship. If he can just show up. If he can just perform. If he can just somehow meet like the need that the coach has for him, then somehow he can be the chosen one if he's just good enough, and the pressure of that weight at times can be crushing. And I think there's seasons when we wonder that. You know, if only I can show up good enough for you, God. If only I can, like, do enough of the spiritual disciplines. If only I can, like, be consistent enough. If only I can, then maybe you will allow me to stay on the in crowd. But that's not what the scriptures tell us here. He doesn't say we are the choice ones. He says we are the chosen ones. It's interesting, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, when God is trying to explain to the people, or the author of Deuteronomy, Moses is trying to explain to the people God's choosing of them. And he says in Deuteronomy 7, he says this, "The Lord did not set his heart on you and choose you because you were more numerous than the other nations, for you were the smallest of all nations. Rather, it was simply that the Lord loves you." That's it. Why has God chosen to love us? Because he loves us. It's the only reason. We didn't earn his love, and so we don't have to fear the fear of losing his love. We are secure in his love. He has come to us, and he has chosen us, and he has brought us in, and he has renewed and transformed us. And when we begin to understand that, people, young leaders, when you begin to understand that, then you become the ones who are most radical about going to the margins and choosing the unchosen and loving and caring for those who are far from God, who are the ones that are on the margins of society, and you go and you bring them in. Why? Because you know what it is to experience being chosen, especially when it's undeserved. And so we have the security that comes in this rootedness that we are a chosen race because of his grace. Not only are we a chosen race, but we are a royal priesthood. Did you hear that? A royal priesthood. We don't just serve the king, we belong to the king. We are a part of his family, his community, and he has given us significant purpose. He says that we are this priesthood. What did priests do? Priests were the ones who stood in the gap between God and the people. They brought the people to God, and they brought God to the people. And what did they do? They prayed for the people. They advocated. They interceded. And this is what we do. As part of the royal priesthood, the greatest work we do is we pray for those that God has placed around us, in front of us, in our care. We intercede for them before the king. We praise. We help the people around us see the beauty of the king, to see his holiness and his justice and his love and his grace and his mercy. We point out the reality of who this king is and how he is our creator and he is magnificent, but he is also with us. He is transcendent and he is imminent, and we speak to the beauty of Jesus to the people around us. We praise him. And then we sacrifice and we serve. And we sacrifice much for the good of others. Why? Because we know that even though being a priest, serving others, might cost us much, it doesn't cost us Jesus, and nothing compares to Jesus, correct? So even when it costs us much, still, like Job, even when we've lost much, and even when the grief is real, and even when serving others costs us much, still in the midst of the tears, we worship because we have God, and God has us. There's nothing that compares to that. We are a chosen people. We are a royal priesthood, and we are a holy nation. We are a group of people that God has called together, and we form a different culture. We live a different way. I remember when Cole was first heading into public high school at KSS, and we were just talking about his role on the team, and he just goes, "Dad, I'm just kind of nervous. I just wonder if I'm going to be able to fit in." And I just stopped and I looked at him. I said, "Oh, son, if you choose to follow Jesus, fitting in really isn't the option. I'm going to be honest with you, man." And he was like, "What?" I go, "Oh, no. Yeah, seriously. Like, if you choose to follow Jesus, you live according to a very different set of values and virtues in the culture around you. Let's be clear. Like, this isn't your world. You're on mission in this world. You sacrifice much in this world. But this isn't where you belong. You're part of a holy nation. You're part of a different way of being. You have different motives. You have different values. You have a very different purpose. You're different." And then, listen to this, and we know this, right? When we begin to understand that we are a part of a holy nation, a very different culture, then we're not so shocked when our cultural sensibilities become offended by what God is calling us to. Isn't that true? In fact, the reality is that at some point, the scriptures, God's way, will offend all of our cultural sensibilities. Why? Because our culture didn't create him. And he's calling us to a very different way of being. And this is part of our essence, who we are. This is our identity. The first thing, if we are going to be a generation that's going to have a courageous, rooted faith, and if we're going to pass on a faith that is rooted and courageous, the first thing we need to understand is we need to know who we are. That we are a chosen race and there is security. We are a royal priesthood, there is mission and purpose. And we are a holy nation. We belong as a different group of people to a different way of being. And we're on mission to bring God's way, his kingdom way, into the spaces that he has placed us. First, we need to know who we are. Second, if we're going to have a courageous faith, and if we're going to pass on a courageous faith to the next generation, then we need to help the next generation, then we need to know not just who we are, but more importantly, we need to know whose we are. That at the very foundation of identity, the number one question, the first question is actually not, who are you? That's actually not the first question. The first question we have to answer is, whose are we? Listen to what he says. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. Did you hear that? We're a people for his own possession. He goes on and he says, once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. This is such an offensive concept in the cultural reality we live in right now, isn't it? This idea that we do not belong to ourselves, that we do not have ownership or rights over ourselves, but instead we belong to someone else. You know, it's interesting, we were teaching the other day to our students and we were just talking about this idea of identity formation and how different kind of the cultural ethos around identity formation is from a gospel ethos when it comes to identity formation. You know, we live in a culture that tells our students over and over again that you can be whoever you want to be, you can do whatever you want to do, you can accomplish whatever you want to accomplish. And so what our culture says is that when it comes to identity formation, when it comes to a sense of like finding yourself, the first thing you should do is look in yourself. And whatever you feel, whatever you want, whatever you think about yourself, that's who you are. And then what you need to do is you need to go out and express that identity to the people around you and find a community that will affirm what you think about yourself. And if you're in a space where a community doesn't seem to affirm what you think about yourself, then what you should do is figure out a way to cancel that community so you don't have to feel so bad about what they think about yourself. And then finally, you'll go in a space where you'll just begin to present who you are to the environment around you. You know, when I'm talking with sociologists and psychologists and some of the people, especially within faith communities, one of our wonderings right now is that if the reason we are facing perhaps one of the biggest mental crises amongst adolescents today that we've seen in a very, very long time is because we have so embraced this way of thinking about identity and it's left us with nothing. It's left us hollow. It's left us empty. It's left us open to manipulation. If my feelings are the definer of who I am, then people can quite easily manipulate that. It's left us with fear. What if who I want to be is not actually who I can be? There's so many things in my life that I would love to be that it's just impossible for me to actually achieve it. It's not actually what I was designed for. It leaves me wondering if what if who I want to be now is not actually what I want down the road. What do I do then? What if I fail? And what if someone speaks against me? Not only are we now having an argument, but what I'm experiencing is an attack because you're not just disagreeing with me, you're attacking who I am, and it leaves us fragile, and it leaves us without resilience. But God comes to us and he says, there's a better way. The way of identity is not who am I, but whose am I? The gospel tells us that the voice that should have the most power in defining who we are is not our voice, it's God's voice. And this is incredibly good news because God is the one who has created us, so he knows us better than we even know ourselves. Isn't that true? And not only does he know us, but he radically loves us, shown through his work on the cross when he chose to give himself for us, so that not only has he created us, but now he recreates us. And he continues to recreate us. He who began a good work is carrying it on to completion. And when we hear his voice speak over us and we surrender to the one who knows us better than we know ourselves and the one who loves us infinitely more than we could ever dream or imagine and is infinitely wiser than ever we could even imagine, then all of a sudden in that space there becomes a strength. When we begin to understand whose we are, it creates in us an incredible courage. We don't fear failure because our failures or successes don't own us anymore. God does. And there's nothing he can't redeem. Isn't that good news? There's absolutely nothing he can't redeem. Praise God. When we understand this identity, then we no longer fear what others say about us. We're not fragile. What God says about us matters most, and it doesn't change. So all of a sudden, we can become a people who are resilient, strong, and secure. When we understand whose we are, it shifts us from riding an emotional roller coaster. Even what we feel no longer dictates what is true. What God says is true. And we fight to have his truth begin to shape our feelings. And all of a sudden, we have volition, we have strength, we have resilience. And then when we understand whose we are, there is this beautiful humility. We realize that we don't have to compete and compare with others. We're not better than others. We're not worse than others. We are God's. We're his. And so instead of fighting and competing and comparing, we simply humbly serve. And our lives have significance. And we are a people that begin to radically love the other. He gives us so much resources to love the other. The gospel enables us to love the other. We're not scared of the other. The other doesn't own us. Their voices don't control us. We're simply here to serve the other because that's what Jesus modeled for us, even to the point of when the other is our enemy. Isn't that true? We're not even afraid of our enemy anymore because God has called us not to conquer our enemy. He's called us to serve and love our enemy. And he's empowered us to do so. And there is such a strength when we realize whose we are. If we're going to have a courageous faith, first, we need to know who we are. We're a chosen race. We're a royal priesthood. We're a holy nation. Second, we need to know whose we are. We belong to the King. And his voice has the most power in our lives. What he says is true about us. Not what others say, not what we feel, what he says. And there's stability and resilience and strength, courage and humility. And then finally, we need to know what we are. And so Peter goes on and he says this. He says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." Did you hear that? This is the purpose. This is the mission, that we would proclaim the excellencies of Jesus. How beautiful is that? You know, as followers of Christ, there are many things that we should be about, things that we should do. Absolutely, we should stand against injustice. We should stand for those who are on the margins. We should stand against values in our culture that are destructive for people. We should be those people. But the thing that we should be most known for is we should be a people on mission proclaiming the excellencies of Jesus. This is what we should be about. Helping people see the beauty of Jesus and the work that he's done and the work that he continues to do. That he is the one who fills all of the deepest desires that he has designed us with, that we, our sense of peace and purpose is met in the one who created us, that when we see the beauty of Jesus who continues to be with us, it changes everything, and this is our mission. And mission is the right word to use. And mission isn't something that we go do, it's actually who we are. We're on mission. In fact, when you look at the scriptures, you know, Jesus doesn't make any differentiation between being a Christian and being on mission. This is actually who we are. If we are a Christian, we are on mission. We are proclaiming the excellencies of Jesus. This is us. This is all of who we are. Whatever position we fill, whether it's as a student, whether it's as a parent, whether it's as someone working at Starbucks, whether it's as someone working here at the church, it's mission. This is what God has called us to. You know, when I talk with students, you know, one of the things that we might talk about sometimes is, hey, I'm really struggling in feeling or experiencing Jesus. And one of the questions I'll ask is, well, tell me about your mission. What mission are you on right now? How are you looking to, like, honor the Lord and serve others? Where is that? And they'll just like, that's not really a part of who I am. And so then I'm kind of like, oh, well, maybe there's a reason why we're not experiencing Jesus. Have you ever noticed in the scriptures that almost without exception, when Jesus calls his people to go on mission, the Great Commission, his people in the Old Testament, et cetera, et cetera, almost without exception, he says, and lo, I am with you always. And lo, I'm with you. And when you begin to read it, you begin to realize that the call to mission is the call to intimacy. That this is actually where we experience Jesus as we begin to understand our lives, our mission, and our lives are his. And it's in this space where we begin to experience the beauty of Jesus. And so then in this space, we proclaim the excellencies of Jesus. And this is what we're called to. Wherever we are, in whatever moment, God has called us to this wonderful, eternal, significant work of proclaiming the excellency of Jesus. So let me ask a question. Students, do you have a missional vision for your life? Do you know what I mean? When you go to your high school, when you go to the university, when you're in your workplace, do you have a missional vision for your life? Do you understand that God has sovereignly placed you in that space to do the good works that he has put together beforehand that you would walk in them? Do you know what I mean? There's purpose there. Parents, do we have a missional vision for our children? You know what I mean? Like, we have lots of visions for our kids, don't we? I mean, I coached a lot of basketball with my son. I had a vision for him that one day, you know, he'd play this game and it would maybe save me paying quite as much as I need to for his education. That'd be awesome. But I had to, like, wrestle with that when God said, yeah, but is that the extent of your vision? Because he's like, there's just so much more. You know, I've found that when God's convicted me in my life about the vision I have for my kids, it begins to reset a few priorities. Instead of my primary vision for my kids being their happiness, it starts to become more about their holiness. You know what I mean? Hey, son, I know it's going to be hard for you to make that decision with your friends, but God's calling you to something more. And I'm with you, but it's going to be hard. He's calling you to something more. It starts to change from my primary vision being about his competency, his ability to be able to perform well in his job and raise, like, a good salary so that he can be secure for his family. Don't get me wrong. It's important to be good in our jobs and what we're looking at and how we can function in those spaces. But all of a sudden, I'm not so much about his competency, but I'm more about his character. What kind of a man are you going to be in the environment that God's placed you? What kind of a woman are you going to be as he asks you to lead in that space? Who are you? Who are you? I begin to shift away from just thinking about security to starting to think about stewardship. Is the vocation you're leaning into going to allow you to steward who God's made you to be, your gifts, skills, and ability, to begin to, like, reach out for the good of others as opposed to just make as much income as possible so you can have security? There's something more here. It's not just security, it's stewardship. In raising our kids, I move from just protection, and protection is important, but I move to preparation. How can we prepare you for what God is calling you into in the world where he's placed you? And then I shift from removing them from the world to begin to live as missionaries with them in the world. And this was such a different one for me. I remember when God said to me and just really said, hey, you have a responsibility to be with your son on mission in his world. And it changed the conversations we started to have. I remember driving him to school one day, and on our way to school, I just said to him, I said, hey, buddy, I know you got some guys on your basketball team that God's asking you to love, huh? He goes, yeah. well, who are they? I love to pray for them. I want to pray for you. Tell me about who they are. And so then he shares that, and good, and I prayed for him. And then I said, hey, you know what, son? He goes, what, Dad? I think God's asking me to love their parents, kind of like he's asking you to love them. He's kind of like, oh, that's weird. I said, would you pray for me? You know what I mean? Like, he was like 12. It's like, Dad, I don't really pray for you very much. I know it's time. It's going to be great. I could use it. But I said, would you pray for me as I love his dad and as I love his dad? And all of a sudden, there was this shift to go, hey, this isn't just about like us guarding ourselves. It's about what God would have for us in the space where we are. And we're in this together. And this is what roots generations, when generations are in this together. When generations are in this together, it reminds us who we are. It allows us to tell the stories of God's faithfulness. It gives us hope for the future. It gives us a vision of who we are to be. This is what it means to pass courageous faith on to the next generation. Let me just close with this. Just a thought. You know, when we sense the affirmed values of the culture becoming more and more opposed to the values of Jesus, we can tend to become anxious, defensive, angry, and antagonistic. We can. And we're in one of those seasons, aren't we? I mean, this is a season that's tough. We're setting up our conferences for the fall, and we're right now looking at how AI is affecting the faith formation of the next generation. And 2 days ago, I was on a call with Dr. Huizinga from Seattle, and she works in the area of AI development within Microsoft Research, and she's a person of faith, and she told me some of the things that are coming down the pipe, and I was like, I could feel my anxiety rising. We can find ourselves in a world that feels out of control. There's a type of anxiety that can tend to rise. When we feel our homes are threatened, we can feel like we're victims. And we can become very protective in this space, very isolated, very scared. But my friends, here's the reality. This world is actually not our home, and we are not victims. We're not. We're missionaries in this place for a short time. And God has promised that he is with us, and he will restore and redeem all things, and he's not out of control. Even when it feels like we are, he is not. And neither are our children. We are aliens and strangers. We are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, called by God to this moment. Young leaders, you are called by God to this moment. If God hadn't called you to this moment, you wouldn't be here. Parents and grandparents, we have been called to this moment, and so have your children and grandchildren. God has a missional plan and design for him. It's not by accident that we are in this space. We are not victims. When we begin to understand this truth, that we are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, called by God to this moment, when we understand this, we shift from being anxious and angry to being a people who are humble and courageous. And instead of primarily thinking about how to protect the next generation, we begin to think about how to prepare the next generation. And we move forward by God's grace with courageous faith in the one who has gone before us. Let me pray. Father, I love you. Thank you so much for who you are. Lord, remind us over and over again of the truth, not just of who we are, but who you are. And the fact that we belong to you, our lives are not our own, and that is such good news. Man, that's such good news. And through your word, may we hear the truth and see the truth of who you are, and may that shape us to be a people who, because of who you are, can have a non-anxious presence in the midst of a chaotic world at times. Give us a vision of who you would have us to be. Give us a vision of how to model and pass on a courageous faith. And then, Lord, I think about my friends here who are in high school and college. And Father, you have called them to something even more. You have sovereignly put them in this moment, and you have given them a way of thinking and an intuition to know how to be faithful in this space in ways that are foreign to some of us who are older. And I thank you for calling them to this. Renew in them an understanding of you, renewing them an understanding of who you've made them to be and the calling you have on their lives. And may they be strong, firm, and steadfast for your glory, for their joy and for the good of the people they serve. In your name, amen.